This is Catherine Hastings, and you're listening to Word Temple on KRZB 91.1 FM. On February 18th of 2017, the live Word Temple Poetry Series hosted three poets, Sonoma County poet Bill Vartna, John Shoptaw, and Devorah Major. It was a really stellar evening at Word Temple. I'm going to play as much of it as I can right now. I may have to cut some things out due to time constraints. I also want to make a note that we had a sound issue at the Art Center that night, so the quality won't be as good as it usually is, but you'll be able to hear the readings just fine. So let's move on now to the Word Temple Poetry Series at the Sebastopol Center for the Arts with Bill Vartna, John Shoptaw, and Devorah Major.
Good evening, everybody. Thanks for coming. We have some wonderful poets here tonight. We're going to open with Bill Vartna, who many of you know, and I'll introduce in just a minute. And we have John Shoptaw up here from Berkeley, and the wonderful Devorah Major, who read for Word Temple a long time ago. So some of you may have experienced that performance, but I'm really happy to have you back. So I'm going to introduce Bill. He was born and raised in Petaluma, right here in Sonoma County, and he served as the county's 7th Poet Laureate. So I think that ended about 4 years ago, 3 years ago now. And he's the author of a number of collections, including Suburbs of My Childhood and In Concern for Angels, among others. He's been a published poet since 1972, and he became an independent publisher of poetry when he started Torrey and Horn Press. Please welcome Bill Vartna.
Last time I read at Word Temple, I read my Orion poems. This time I'm going to read my Sirius poems. But I'm going to read one Orion poem because it was written for David Meltzer, and he passed on New Year's Eve. A story has rained upon our unconscious minds. Whether we choose to believe it or not, the dream comes with its universe, like the flooding of the Nile, and each flood its variations, whether spiritual, astronomical, psychological, and/or political. Each must touch the body of man, woman, either building it, stretching it, molding, breaking, or killing it. Life is our school, to be and. So prepare for the next flood. Dig your ditches soon enough. Dig them deep and far and wide enough to handle the next inundation. Remember to turn the soil, open the earth. For the story moves us forward, or we do not move forward. We know it is made up with words we use every day and dreams we have dreamt, whether we remember them or not, and that somewhere the word for our dream is but one letter away from becoming comfort, salvation, peace. The right combination of our conscious blood, sweat, and laughter, tears like the flood, are a gift, can change this word to the one we think is better or richer or true. This is my ode to Sirius. And I should say, the Dogon Eric mentioned here, and I don't really give them a lot of... the Dogon, who were now in Mali, started out in Egypt 4,000 years ago and were part of that culture. And they can read, they can go to Egypt and read that. They still know all the symbols and everything. And they also, in their culture, knew that Sirius was at least a double star. I think they were the ones who say it's a triple star. But and that was 4,000 years ago. We just figured it out last century. So that's where the Dogon are. Ode to Sirius. Sirius, the brightest star we know, we can see, surrounded by dark rays of energy, of music. The tides of my blood listen, I do not comprehend. Atoms dance like mist off an ocean, break off, regroup, a new molecule. Detritus picked up as discovery. I am composed of atrocities committed. I come back redeemed, a saxophone solo, this spinning blue in its expansive black. We have Dogon. I look up at the moon. Starlight touches three blades of grass 4 millennia ago, gleams inside my body now. The Dogon knew. The Dogon knew Sirius is a double star. Cells remember all previous forms they have been part of. The world gets faster. Mirrors don't stop. We stand on Earth looking up. Good circulation in my feet. In the beginning, there was Isis, oldest of the old. Souls disperse into Earth, moon, and other instruments of time. The sun is revolving fire. How beautiful, the lichen dried on hillstone. Once on ocean's floor, the colony of ants who prescribe a particular path, the free will of deviant lights. I stand before you. I could be sitting. It could be any time. The moon was once called celestial Earth. How influential we have found this in silence. In deep space, a star implodes. I remember more than 40 years ago, in this life, I was sleeping on the beach in Corfu. I experienced the Milky Way, and I was a part of it. We all were, even those who weren't born yet, and those who died millenniums before. I was in their number. O Sirius, there are those who shine a light brighter that others of us disappear in our elliptical paths around this presence. The beauty can quite often bring us to our knees, yet it's the totality that's humbling. When we piece it together, words find no foothold. Stories abound, some breathing with a life of their own. Soul bursts the body each morning. After an endless night of stretching the universe, ego shines, reflects, a foothold. All things are in their own heaven. Each is moved together with its sphere to the east and revolves by itself according to breadth and depth and about its proper center. Stardust for Avacha. I am sitting in Aqua's Cafe, planet Earth, sipping a cappuccino, reading and writing about Sirius, how 4,000 years ago the Egyptians saw archetypes in the nighttime sky. Mother Isis is as Sirius, our brightest star. A double, maybe three stars orbiting each other. Radiant Sirius A, held by the collapse of Sirius B, now a white dwarf, the ascension of Osiris to a higher, more exalted frequency. Isis recreated Osiris's earthly power in Sun Horus, and circling Sirius C, not seen since 1929, the year of the Great Depression, as Sister Nephthys, the hidden one, a water goddess, feminine Neptune, ruler of the unconscious, a mythical drama we've carried forward. Only the names have changed. The names have been changed. I remember riding a muni bus in the mission many years ago, standing, holding on to the overhead rail, neck craned, looking up at my first book by H.D., who introduced me to this story, thinking, I don't understand. Thinking, this is different. Being exposed to an unacknowledged self, enthralled, seeing one thing and also seeing another through it, through time. Stars are not in time. Time, a human tool. Time, how we fight against chaos. Against Set, Osiris's brother, Isis's brother, Nephthys's brother. Stars shine through human darkness, through space, through time. Do you see? In the nighttime sky, an outer space of star radiance, an inner space of star radiance. Joker moon riding, never-ending wave reflecting, and each human, each one of us, in our lifetimes, particles of light. Thank you.
All right. John Shaw is here to read from his collection, Times Beach. And we have copies of all of the books of poetry over at the table tonight. It's a book that Robert Hass says is like a hybrid of Hart Crane, the Depression photographs of Dorothea Lange, and a 19th century lantern show, they called them panoramas, of the human and environmental history of our mightiest river system, the Mississippi. He goes on to say that the poems come from a deep sense of the rhythms and dialects of a place and from a deeply literary and inventive imagination. And he really nailed it. Like, that was such a great blurb. Choctaw was raised in the dreamed Mississippi River floodplain of the Missouri Bootheel, where he picked cotton, was baptized in a drainage ditch, and worked in a lumber mill. How many people do you know with that resume? Okay. All of this and more is reflected in poems like Blues Haiku, Little River Coils, Tongues, and so many more. When you open a book and read lines like, a little polish on the privates will drown the chigger in the itch, you know, these are poems you'll not only want to read, but you'll have to read them out loud. They're just great. And we get to learn things at the same time, not only from his poems, but from the epigraphs that he's chosen for many of the poems, some by Alfred Lord Tennyson, John James Audubon, John L. Hancock, the sharecropper poet, among others. Times Beach is the winner of the 2015 Notre Dame Book Prize and the 2016 Northern California Book Award in Poetry. Some of the poems first appeared in places like The New Yorker, Colorado Review, and elsewhere. He's also published a critical study, On the Outside Looking Out, John Ashbery's Poetry, which was published by Harvard, and a libretto on Lincoln's assassination for an opera by Eric Sawyer, Our American Cousin. He teaches poetry writing, eco-poetry, and Emily Dickinson, in the English department of the University of California at Berkeley. His essay, Why Eco-Poetry, was published in Poetry. So please welcome this very talented and knowledgeable man, John Shanta.
Well, I think I wrote a version of a poem that probably a lot of poets have written, I started mine the day after the election. So it's called The Weather Between the States. The sun, the evening after the election, plummeted into the Pacific, sinking the sharp-shadowed coast and also the Atlantic seaboard into an ice-blue darkness. Meanwhile, the southern and the middle states heard snowmelt trickling through snow and dug themselves out of their media dens into an unbelievably roseate spring. The coastal and the urbanized could not adjust to the unforeseen and unforecast cold snap. They muted their audio, wiped moist breath from their windshields, and craned their necks for a turnoff. Like those on the oceans, folks in the river-drained interior couldn't believe their eyes. They pinched themselves or said, "Pinch me," to each other, when really they just wanted to dream. On call or commuting from service counter to counter, they scanned the skies for early signs of jobs migrating back north. But they saw only winter on the wing. Still, they'd keep watch till bedtime. Both the dull blue and the red-flushed grown-ups read to their children, who noticed their voices were edged with chill or with gleam, suffered their shivering or their hearty hugs, and burrowed more deeply into their woolen stories. Or, if they asked what was wrong, were told that the season had flipped, but that they would be fine. Either way, readers on edge checked their windows and blinds and their watches for their adolescents, who braved the weather in anthem-drenched blocks in coats storm-resistant or repellent, or who smoked in Indian summer light by country convenience markets and made plans for evacuating to the city. This is a poem I wrote this summer, which I believe is already out of date, and I, in fact, hope it is. It's called Dry Song. The drought has pierced to the tan oak root, and the wine tastes like wildfire smoke. It pierces the aquifer with an almond drill, scatters the chances of precipitation with the young sun on the tender crops, and discovers in the lake bed a gold rush town. If we knew the Sierras folded snow on snow, we could find the pass from bed to shut-eye. But the drought has pierced to the mountain root and shown us rock under the shrunken mantle and starved the hungry river mouths, barring salmon in the reds from salmon in the sea. Atmospheric river, radar vapor, damp ghost of the Sacramento. Why, when your blessed showers could soothe? Why only days of speechless blue? Forest numb with riddled pine. So I know I've invoked the atmospheric river. We'll see what happens later on this evening. Most adaptable bird on the planet is a bird known as the cattle egret, and it's classified as least concern on its conservation status. It's remarkable how they've spread across, I think, every continent except Antarctica. I remember when the birds came to the swampland of southeast Missouri, and it was so startling to see them suddenly walking alongside cows, alongside cattle, or even riding on them. And they did look like some strange mythological beast to me. And I should mention that the word cattle is short for capital, as in per capita, like counting. That's least concern. Chimerical, the rhinoceros egret, its keratin dehorned in South Africa, and container ship to Vietnam or China, where it's ground by aphrodisiacs and snorted by affluent boneheads, metamorphs into the hippopotamus egret, the elephant, Cape Buffalo, zebra, giraffe, the ostrich, and the Campbell egret, the deep-domed tortoise, and, in the Americas, the cow heron, or cattle egret. Ranging like wildfire over the last century, a migration brought it by the transmutation of forests into ranches. The cattle egret writhes and champs and tilts and plods and darts in cursive at grasshoppers. And where its livestock gets concentrated, decapitated, tenderized, charred, whatever, the bibulcus ibis or cattleman waiter, capitalizing on a field without cattle, reinvents itself as the tractor egret, which I've seen. Though the unattached bird is emblem enough of the other end of extinction, ignition, when not just its shaggy breeding crest and breast plumage go up in flame, but its legs, beak, lores, and irises catch color. Now, from the book, Big River book, took me forever to finish. The book begins with this sequence of poems called Blues Haiku, which is it's a hybrid of the haiku with the Mississippi Delta blues tercet. I'm hoping you can hear each of them in these. I want to blur from a tupelo stump, like a crawfish in an endangered swamp. A purple blur from a tupelo stump. Then that crawfish pinching moss off a cypress knee. So standoffish. Ground fog swirling, smelling fresh as death when the wind disturbs it. Ground fog swelling, ammonia smell, fresh as death. Somebody mopping the kitchen or baking meth. What moving violation, unpaid citation, peccadillo, drove you, bandito? From what Amarillo, what crime against nature, peccadillo? So far to the north, oh, nine-banded tire tread, armadillo. The pileated drummer's walk, it was unignorable that was my song. The drummer's slow walk, 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 it was unignorable. And not the sweet, sweet, sweet prothonotary's warble. I'll say you will not find unignorable and warble in rhyming dictionaries, but where I'm from, it's a perfect rhyme. I might just walk barefoot down to that moody Mississippi, like a sigh to the Ganges. Might work my feet into the mud of that mighty Mississippi, in the name of no power in the mud, but the muddy Mississippi's. This one was written after the BP oil explosion. The towpath to the deep south, it don't feel too well, and it makes me woozy. Towpath to the river mouth, no, it don't feel too well. Laid up with a laughing gull and a brown pelican shell. Upon a mound of sand boil stared the witness tree, since before the quake. On the sand boil glared the red oak hanging tree, till the mercy bolt cut it down out of its misery. That lopsided frame house where my mother was born, I would pull it all down, that lopsided house frame where my mom was born, but it'd only be back up early the following morn. Down an imitative river road, in the warbler inflected breeze. Anything else? The old channel's tree line in the warbler inflected breeze. Lemon, 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 catfish and hush puppies. Now a few from my baptism poem called Wahite, which was the drainage ditch where I was baptized into the church of my girlfriend I was crazy in love with. This first poem I'm reading is called Girdled, which is something was done with trees. We're so big around that you could not saw them, so they would just take off the bark and kill the tree that way. The dark cypress swamp giving way to the Swampland Act of 1850, sinking to rise no more, slatches and sand ridges quaking still, is superseded by the Little River Drainage District, a system of channels, tacks, and concrete setback levees, water detention basins for catching malarial night airs. The few stubborn beaver dams, which staunched the runoff, once they're dynamited clear, a rich black loam is reclaimed, unfurrowed, sown in swamp chestnut oak and sweet gum stumps, cut over bald cypresses, drowned bone white, or coming back up brown kneed, lost without their deep understory, the resurrection fern. Stumps thick as dragon's teeth, pumpkin ash, bur oak, shell bark hickory, possum haw, slippery elm, a 130-foot persimmon stump, having stumped the dragline crawlers, walking draglines, steam-powered stump pullers, where migratory snake birds fly over and cottonmouths yawn, stumps that, one dark morning, get on up and take their places, back of a hickory plow to plow or a hoe to chop. The baptism in itself, it's called castor glands. Wahite, this ditch that goes all the way down through to Arkansas, is a kind of straightened afterlife of Castor River. And castor, you may know, comes from the word for beaver. Castor glands, brother Pascal, feet planted in Wahite, where bright angel feet have trod, with the authority given to him from Delmo Baptist Church by Jesus Christ, tilting John back with one hand under his backbone into the water, pinching the other over his mouth and nose, John musing on Sherry Kay's Pudenda. How else to explain what I see next? Watches as a veering brown current, sleek and nippy as any from Castor River, firms and fattens into a yearling beaver that dips and swirls up before John's face and shows its incisors, enraptured, it seems, to have found him or caught him, as Castor at last, his bollocks, pollex, before it dives over, that is, under John's startled head, making as if to bite off his shrunken scrotum for its sharp and leathery perfumed castoreum. John, groping for the belt loops of his dress pants, had he worn them, when up bobs the singing embankment, Brother Pascal grinning at him, "You're saved!" Happened just like that, too.
This is Catherine Hastings, and you're listening to Word Temple on KRCB 91.1 FM. Let's return now to John Shoptaw, who will be followed by Devorah Major.
This is my resurrection poem, and it's written in memory of D.L.H. Sr. It's called Twice. What makes me think there's anything here anymore? I could raise up writhing out of this drowned river. I might as well try catching two fish off the same worm. Big Lionel swears you can. He's living with cancer now in an assisted living facility, where he's begun, now and then, to recollect the same thing twice. He used to get the horse weeds round the side of the road, and he'd stop and find the weeds with the knots in them, slice off 7-inch sticks and throw them in the bottom of the boat, and that'd be his bait. He'd split a stick end to end, and the little horse weed would be laying there feeding on the marrow of the wood. He'd take the worm out, put it on a small hook. He'd have a slipshod sinker and a small floater, and he'd put it out on a long, about a 14-foot pole and 14-foot of line on it, and he'd just dabble it around bald cypress logs and down into hollow cypress stumps alive with fish, and likely spots that a fish might be in the creek, and when they hit it, he'd just jerk a little and he'd get his fish caught, which he caught a lot of bluegill. Mostly bluegill, but also goggle-eye, red ear, which is also called a shell cracker. It feeds on snails on the bottom of the creek and a crappie now and then, and he'd catch a bass occasionally, and occasionally a catfish. So he'd be fishing for bluegill, like he says, with about a 14-foot pole. He had about 14-foot of line on it where he could toss it out round to likely spots where a fish might be. And when they hit it, his little floater'd go under and he'd jerk and catch his fish. Now, a cricket is soft, and by the time a fish catches that, he actually grabs it in his mouth and he tears it up. But a horseweed is tough, and he stays on. And you can catch half a dozen fish sometime, and the fish would still be hitting at this brown and yellow skin hanging on the hook, which he caught a lot of bluegill. And in the name of Castor River, Little River Drainage District, Wahai Drainage Ditch, and in the name block lettered on the long gone railroad station's long gone sign, W.A. Height, I put out this poem on about a 4 to 5 foot line. And in the name of John, I dabble it about bald cypress stumps and likely spots. And I keep my keyboard running and my eye upon the floater. Some time back, I said to my partner, what if my parents had not met on that St. Louis streetcar? I would not exist. Our daughter would not exist. And she said, you know, I don't think love is that fragile. And I thought, okay, I need this wisdom. This is called The Odds Against Us. Then again, maybe so. What if he'd landed the job? The stars would wink back. She'd have been working late, would, if in luck, have boarded the block before. Her fingers stained with streaming, hand-colored sunsets. 10 cents a card. Fireflies, blue moon, almost a cause. The night's last streetcar must have crackled to a halt. Olive Street in 1941. On deck, no seat. Then he lit on hers. But would he feel odd? He needed a smoke because he wanted her number. But would he be given the nod? No odds or even. And what about us? Were we coaxed from afar? We'll never know better. Or were we a coincidence waiting to concur? What if the twilight had failed her? Her haunting cards might well have been blurred and blackened. They'd ride lost in second thoughts. The son of a bitch and job had got away. She cut a deal about her age and worked for nothing. 100 mud-pied sunsets. But wait, she wouldn't have known that yet. So what if he hadn't happened to have had a pencil? She wouldn't have minded. The hand against any two things happening is high. But luck is fibrous, nebular, overriding, and ruddiest when the stellar core fails. She'd reach inside her purse, pull out her lipstick, hand-paint her number all the way up his sleeve. The whole car had to have laughed. His starched and flattened arrow shirt, her piecework red. And that did happen. The county I was raised in, which we call New Madrid County, is the it's the epicenter of the great New Madrid earthquakes of 1811 and 1812. These were sizable quakes that brought people out of apartment buildings in New York City and rang church bells in Boston. There were many signs people felt during the earlier in the year for the coming quake, none more strange than this vast migration of squirrels from, I guess it was Indiana, tens of thousands of squirrels all left the trees and started migrating south. One contemporary traveler said, no obstacles seemed to check this extraordinary and concerted movement. The word had been given them to go forth, and they obeyed it. Though multitudes perished in the broad Ohio, which lay in their path. This one's called Ghost Squirrels. Not out of the woods, not even now. We have yet to arrive at our theory of commotion. What mad word came over us, some now think? What hounded us out of tree was a whiff of radon, or else a not well anticipated emission of rotten egg. Some of us sense an undertone, a locomotive tingling way down in our amygdala, which roused us indignant from our lifelike sleep. But such explanations, we feel, only further our bleak bewilderment. What it was an unaccountable flurry of shadow tail, a barely readable dictation of innumerable plumes we'd squirreled away ages ago, like a report card without opening. Trees intertangled, shadows malformed disagreeably. We cast ourself a significant look, as though we knew something we didn't. We hoarded mass, chattered and chuckled, allegroomed and mated much as before. But a cold drizzle of coincidence stopped us all together, as though we just realized what we'd been up to. Tail a quiver, we poured down trunk and flooded the forest floor. An ordeal, to be sure, but also an oddly moving experience. Deer, even bear, fled our fuzzy determination. Navigating by stars or by each other, it was better together. Needy, distrustful, we were what we could never rightly recollect. The river changed us unrecognizably, though we go on like nothing happened. The book comes to a rather definitive end with the poem The Dead Zone. Dead zones, you may know, from the Gulf of Mexico. Dead zones are waters of oxygen-depleted bodies of water where such that a fish can't breathe, underwater creatures can't breathe in the water, and it creates these dead zones. And in my area, they're created by being downstream from the great global corn market. Corn futures surging, an international harvester swallows a hybrid field in a prolonged gulp. Hauled to New Madrid's Cargill elevator, by October, the load is floated in a barge fleet, clear down to the Gulf. Out through the Panama locks, the corn deep steamship docks at Qingdao, home to a beer and a dolphinarium. The non-GMO gets shipped from Buffalo Island to Rotterdam, the EU's port of entry, once it leaves the Gulf. Fresh from marsh gas reserves in Siberia, or in Qatar, where young executives study golf, bags of ammonia fertilizer offloaded onto barges or hauled up river in a long tow, clear from the Gulf. Spun each spring from a fertilizer buggy, the urea the corn camp use runs off with the downpours to dissolve into Otter Slough, pouring into Little River, pouring into the San Francis, pouring into the Mississippi, on down to the Gulf. Nutrients mumbled from the river's swollen mouth get eaten by algae that bloom then drop onto Louisiana's shelf, where they're eaten by bacteria, sucking oxygen from still waters, leaving brittle stars, ghost shrimps, fiddler crabs, worms, gasping on the bottom of the Gulf. The future lies downriver, It'll come about when the Mississippi signs its muddy hieroglyph. No moonlight special, and it's 12:30. Watch for pelicans. They know the way to the Gulf. Thank you so much.
We are gathered together to celebrate with Deborah Major her fifth collection of poetry, And Then We Became. It was published by City Lights Press just last year. She's one of our favorite poets to visit Word Temple over the years. Al Young says, "The local, the global, the personal, the political, the intimate, and the infinite all intersect and reflect one another in the mirrored imagery of Deborah Major's poetry." Who are we as humans, right? Who are we humans with all of our differences, our different cultures, our different languages, our different backgrounds, everything? In her book, And Then We Became, questions of culture, ethnicity, and gender play very large roles in the atmosphere of politics, compassion, and perhaps most importantly, connection, right? Why we're here tonight. With poems like History of the Canary Island Whistlers and Brown Lady in White, your heart really will just crack open. Jewel Gomez says that Deborah Major wraps myths and headlines, family lore and visions in language both delicate and tough, enticing us to dive in even though the poem she serves up may have dangerously sharp edges. Deborah Major is California-born. She was raised in San Francisco, as I was. She's the granddaughter of immigrants, documented and undocumented. Major served as San Francisco Poet Laureate. She was the third one of that city. She has two novels published, Brown Glass Windows and An Open Weave. In addition to her five poetry collections and four poetry chapbooks, she has two biographies for young adults and a host of short stories, essays, and individual poems published in anthologies and periodicals. Among her awards is a First Novelist Award from the Black Caucus of ALA for An Open Weave, and a Penn Oakland Joseph E. Miles Literary Award for her poetry book, Street Smarts. In June of 2015, Major premiered her poetry play, Classic Black, Voices of 19th Century African Americans in San Francisco, a disappearing population. And this was performed at the San Francisco International Arts Festival. Please welcome the wonderful Deborah Major.
We are the memory of that place without measure that filled all space that never was and ever will be. That place existing as a perfect note yet making no sound, holding all colors inside a light that was nothing but darkness. We are the memory of a breath that could not be but was, a breath that swelled to bubble that burst and then collapsed. We are the memory gestated in days that lasted eons as the universe womb birthed heat, light, rock, ice, mineral, song, us. We are the impossible made flesh, creating infinite possibilities of hope or endless chasms of despair inside the prayers which we have become. The first section of the book is And Then We Became Spirit, because I think we start as spirit. And actually, I am now, Bill is forced me to read this poem. It's called Nomo, and it's another Dogon poem. It's because the Dogon are such a font of ancient wisdom, okay? And there's one book, Conversations with Ogatamele, where this French guy, Giraud, I think is his name, actually went and had the Dogon system, took dictation from, you know, he just took dictation. It's hilarious reading the book because when they're telling him jokes, it's like he doesn't know they're pulling his leg because all he's doing is doing the dictation. But it tells a lot about the culture. Anyway, Nomo is an African deity. We were, there's always one, and then one breaks off into more than one. And the one is called Amma, and out of Amma came Anomo. But we are there were before us, there was children of the first word that I believe were cloth, and that didn't work out. And then there were children of the second word that were clay, and that didn't work out. We're not doing too good either. So. I feel like this is a humbling story. I mean, well, if there were two before us, there could be four. So this is us, Nomo, how we come to speak. Before a generation passed, we children of the third word knew how to take this gift of language, contorted crimson, and sew it to our teeth. How we mangle this tongue that needs unending translation. We require it to be a constantly changing chameleon, a hypnotist, a con man, a cheat. With words, we manufacture demons who devour souls and erase memory. Look at how often we honor speech that can make us hate, that can cause us to deny our mothers, our brothers, ourself. We have articulated a deadly weapon that subverts knowledge and betrays faith. So how now do we again learn to listen with more than ears? At once try to speak with more than tongue. How now do we put our tongues back in our mouths? Brown Lady in White is actually, she's featured in my novel, and she has this invisible person, and this is a real woman. So the poem is what I wrote about the real woman. And I was meanwhile doing the novel, and she was this main character. And there was something wrong. It wasn't getting her right. So I'm sitting outside, this is when I'm in my San Francisco days, at my P.O. box, which was on Golden Gate near Hyde. And I sent my son in and asked him to go get the mail for me. I'll sit here. And she walks by, and I see her. I've been seeing her for years. And she looks at me, and then she turns around and she starts talking to this invisible, her companion. So that made her this. That's how it came to her. And in the book, she believes herself to be invisible. Brown Lady in White. Have you seen her? She is shadows of Africa, buried underneath a mausoleum of whiteness. Her gingerbread skin cracks through the white paint she brushes over her cheeks, across her forehead, down her neck, to meet a blouse of white, a long white skirt, white stockings, white sneakers, a white cape blanketing away cold and rain mist. She walks engulfed by white, cutting the air so quickly that when she passes, she is often unseen. I have seen her, scurrying down Mission Street, gusting through the Tenderloin, pushing past crowds on Market Street. A friend swears she had seen her in Harlem, and another claims to have caught a glimpse of her in downtown Atlanta. Have you seen her? Is she one of many? She cannot become the whiteness she wraps around herself. Her skin tones break through, proclaiming color. Brown, they insist. When we were young, they sing as they rise above the paint. When we were younger, we glowed in so many browns. She argues with her shadow, cuts the air with aspersions. Her steps are sharp and clipped as she flies down the street, a whirl of discord, brown still underneath the white. Have you seen her? Walking faster and faster still until she almost disappears, shining brown underneath the layers of white. My father told me the story about the Canary Island Whistlers. And it's a true story. So they were in Africa, and they, it's like Nomo is the power of the word created us, okay? And so the word is very powerful. It's very powerful in Africa. You give your words bond. And your word, you can make power with it. So they were on the West Coast. I don't know if they were in Angola or whatever, but they were on the West Coast. And the soldiers were afraid to kill them So they put these men in a boat that they knew would sink in the Atlantic. And this is the true story of what happened. History of the Canary Island Whispers. Needing to show what would happen to enslaved ones who used language as weapon, as poultice, as plow, but afraid to kill those whose mouths held spells and danger, Spanish soldiers cut out their tongues and put those men adrift in a worn boat, confident that the Atlantic would open her gaping mouth and swallow those ominous souls. But decades after the leaky boat landed on Canary Island shores, if you walked across a mountain ridge of that rocky, tear-lined island, you would hear those tongueless men whistling their sadness and joy in Spanish, shaping the air into foreign consonants and vowels, modulating alien tones into verbs and nouns, becoming a new species of blackbirds who would not be silenced and could not be killed. I just love the idea that these men learned to whistle, taught themselves to whistle in Spanish, because their oppressors had spoken in Spanish. City scat. We come to this city of concrete brick, City scat. We come to this city of concrete, brick, steel, and toil. Country people knowing the earth, seafaring people riding the tides, gambling people holding jokers and spades. We come to this city, hard, laughing, weep, sob, wailing, praying, celebrating people, bending and sweating. We come to this hiss, crack, slap, snap, siren, whirl, holler, electric, zip, and burn city. Round and bustling corners, banging our heads against destiny and crumbling brick walls of confusion. We come to this city that can cage us, enrage us, deny us, revile us, turn us from friend and family into prey and predator. We live in this hippo, shiba, dihiba, dihiba, bang, clang city. We come to this city and we name it ours. Losing limbs, one. Such simple things, these hands that are cup and sieve, scissor and cloth, mallet and fan, open lotus blossom and dark-lined clam shells. They have torn and be cleaned and caressed, shuddered and bled, charted with love. The map of my hands is my journey, too. Such simple things, these feet, the scars of my ancestors cut into their souls, carry more than bones, blood, and sinew. As they climbed and wept, danced and stumbled, held kisses and rubbed comfort, bristled and stung, drum and hammer, ladder and cushion, these feet have loved sand and water, oil and touch. Three. Lucky to have lived, he lies still, nothing but memory beneath his trunk. My brother was struck by lightning, lifted up, carried from camera and rock to tree closer to the falls. Sacred water thundered down the mountainside as the people sang praise and promise to Dambala. Carried from camera and rock to tree closer to the falls, he looked with different eyes, forever changed. As the people sang praise and promise to Dambala, he was given fire blessings or a curse that would devour. He looked with different eyes, forever changed. His lens of experience shattered and reshaped, filled with fire blessings or a curse that would devour, seared with the truth of miracles' inevitable scars. With his lens of experience shattered and reshaped, magic unused mushroomed inside his soul, seared with the truths of miracles' inevitable scars, leaving tremors and trembles, stumbling footsteps. Magic unused mushroomed in his soul, while sacred waters thundered down the mountainside, leaving tremors and trembles, stumbling footsteps. My brother was struck by lightning, lifted up. This is called, it's a love chant, it's a sustainer for those of you who are poetry monks. You ask how you were to be sure how, if the poem that does not wear your name was written for you, who is so much more than the name pronounced as Greg. But things are seen and known at the center, even if their truth is unsaid. You wrap around me, pull me close, seek me out each daybreak. We listen together to the warble and shocks of morning birds. We call one another love names, ears open to their whisper. Love does not always crow. Sometimes it has to whisper. Short of breath and eager with the rush of words beside your name, I do not know the nomenclature of the dark dawn singing birds. And as you have pointed out, my poems are not inscribed with the crown of Craig. But I am beginning to recognize those curious bird warbles of daybreak, patterned like our own chirping mornings with nothing left unsaid. We have both said and done ugly things that cannot be unsaid. Raged and forgotten to listen to the darkening day's whisper. Separated by an ocean of bed, we have met daybreak. Me mutely, you ever watchful, vigilant as the meaning of Greg. And one would have thought it was a witch's cackle instead of the song of birds that awoke us, if we had slept at all, with their caucus, raucous calls that never whisper. I once could name more than hawk and sparrow, robin, owl, knew of birds that flew these skies, remembered then so many names now mostly left unsaid. So even if unwritten, love poems hold no other name but Greg, which you should know as you have known my breath in your ear as a whisper. Anyway, it still is true, all said and done, what really is a name except a name. Who we are is always what we find when the sun makes the day break. Even when the sky is thick with lead, showing the grayest of daybreaks, even when the chill that nibbles our heart is stiff in winter air, there are birds, and neither you or I or the woman next door knows all of their names. And does it matter that we speak of their song but leave their title unsaid? Or is what matters you and I and our trembling whispers, is what matters the truth of my love and the mirror reflection that is Greg? Have you heard the young boy sing the chants that are Gregorian? Surety of faith, certainty of moon at night and sun at daybreak. Sometimes inside the harshest storm, you can almost hear their whisper. Exotic and free, like the most unusually colored tropical birds. And you know how I leave the names of deities and saviors unsaid, because it is only the essentials of love that need be named. The night birds sing as we stroke each other beyond passion's whisper, creating a world where nothing is unsaid or unfelt from moonset to daybreak. And every poem of love I coil, written or not, is replete with the name of Greg. And I will end with a teeny tiny poem from the first section. It will show itself to you. Called Human for All of You. Human. Under the brightness, brightest full moon, I am less than a microscopic speck on the edge of the universe's lens. How can a grain of sand be sentient? How can a drop of rain dream? But here I am, singing through the night. Thank
you. You've been listening to Word Temple on KRCB 91.1 FM. If you have any comments or questions, please contact me at khastings@wordtemple.com. Thanks for listening.